Continue, and if you want to turn to the book of Zechariah. Now, Zechariah, it's kind of hard to underestimate the importance of the book of Zechariah in regard to things prophetic. And I have to confess this this is a book that is, I find, in certain respects, difficult. It's not an easy book to, comprehend everything. There are things in it that you're like, I'm not going to go through the whole book, but I want to emphasize there are some really important prophecies regarding the Messiah in Zechariah. Again, Zechariah was prophesying after the exile. He was a contemporary of Haggai, and so this is towards the end of the Old Testament in terms of time. And Zechariah gives several prophecies that relate to the Messiah. Let me just briefly walk through these and then walk through the ones in Malachi. Zechariah chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. Technically not directly speaking of the Messiah, but there are certain things that relate to the Messiah. So let me just read this. It says, "And he showed me Joshua the high priest." Now understand, Joshua was the high priest at that time. He was an associate of Zerubbabel. He showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. Now the angel of the Lord is generally considered to be, in the Old Testament, the pre-incarnate Christ. So that's the first place that the Messiah shows up here. Generally speaking, the angel of the Lord is understood by most to be, and this is how I would understand it, to be the pre-incarnate Christ. "And Satan standing at his right hand to resist him." So Satan here is, if you will, condemning Joshua the high priest. Here's the high priest, the head of the Jewish religious system, if you will, God's appointed high priest, and he is being accused by Satan, the great accuser, resisting him because of his sin. Verse 2, "And the Lord said unto Satan," now again, notice here the Trinitarian language, "The Lord said unto Satan, the Lord rebuke thee, O Satan." This is the angel of the Lord, I believe, saying to the Lord, saying to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you. O Satan, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire?" In other words, here, the angel of the Lord is defending Joshua because he was one chosen by God, pulled out of the fire, that is, from judgment. Verse 3, "Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel. And he answered and spoke unto those that stood before him, saying, Take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, Behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with change of raiment. And I said, Let them set a fair mitre upon his head. So they set a fair mitre upon his head and clothed him with garments, and the angel of the Lord stood by." This is a statement of, again, the imputed righteousness of God, the righteousness of God that was imputed to Joshua. Joshua was unclean, and God clothed him. Again, that's the picture in the New Testament, right? We are clothed in the righteousness of Christ. And here is Joshua. Again, his sins are being removed, and he is being clothed with a pure garment. I think ultimately this is talking about, again, what's going to happen to the nation of Israel. Israel, you know, Joshua representing the nation of Israel, the iniquity of Joshua and the people of Israel will be washed away. They will be clothed with purity and with a garment of righteousness. But it is a statement of, again, the righteousness of God that is a gift. Remember back in Jeremiah chapter 23, where one of the names of the Messiah is, do you remember this? The Lord our righteousness. Jeremiah 23:6, the Lord our righteousness. in the Old Testament, we see already that the righteousness of God is something that we obtain as a gift from God. And this is explained in great detail by Paul in Romans, where it talks about the righteousness of God as a gift, something we receive through faith in Christ. And this is anticipating that aspect of the gospel for sure. But I want to be clear, that was an Old Testament idea. So, how is that accomplished in the case of Israel? How is that accomplished in the case of us? It's through the Messiah. So it's pointing to that work that the Messiah will accomplish. That is the removal of our sin. Now, further down, as you go down through this passage, verse 6, and the angel of the Lord protested unto Joshua, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, if thou wilt walk in my ways, and if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt also keep my courts, and I will give thee places to walk among these that stand by. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, thou and thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at, for behold, I will bring forth my servant the branch. And of course, the branch is the Messiah. Remember, we ran across this title both in Isaiah and in Jeremiah. It's in Isaiah 4, it's in Jeremiah 23, and a couple other places. Let me just look here. I have this. Isaiah 4:2, Jeremiah 23:5, Jeremiah 33:15. It's also chapter 6 of Zechariah here. But this idea of the branch, I again remind you, when you think of a branch, when you think of the branch, I think it has at least two main ideas involved when he calls the Messiah the branch. First, I think it speaks of his origin. He's from David. He's from the line of David. And secondly, it's referring to the fact that he actually brings forth fruit. That is true righteousness. Again, think the picture of John 15 and the vine and the branches. The idea that it is he is the one by whom the Jewish nation will actually bring forth righteousness and bring forth fruit and become fruitful. I think that's the idea behind the branch. For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. So again, pointing to that day when the Jewish people will be purified, which Paul speaks of in Romans 11. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, shall ye carry every man his neighbor under the vine and under the fig tree. And that's a reference to the kingdom. Again, that day when there will be perfect prosperity in the land. So that's messianic. If you look at chapter 6, verses 12 and 13, you again have a statement of the Messiah. He's called the branch. And speak unto him, saying, thus speaks the Lord of hosts, saying, behold, the man whose name is the branch. So again, that's the title of the Messiah. He shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. Even he shall build the temple of the Lord, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest upon his throne. And the council of peace shall be between them both. Now, I want to be clear. This is one of the main aspects of the Messiah. We're going to talk about this on Sunday night again. He will be unique in this sense. He will be both king and priest. Because whenever you see king and priest in one, you know you're talking about the Messiah. Because he's the only one that will be priest and king. And what is he called in relation to that? A priest after the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was the great picture of that. He was king and priest. And the Levites and the sons of Aaron were never kings. There is no king in Israel who was a priest. there was no priest in Israel who was king, because God separated those two out. But the Messiah will be both king, that is, he will rule over the people, and priest. He will intercede for the people. He will be one. The council of peace shall be between them both. I'll just stop there. But this is, again, the Lord is the one. Again, this speaks of the Davidic covenant. You know, he would build the house of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Let's see. Next passage, if you go over to chapter 9, verses 9 and 10. Again, these verses are well known because referring to the triumphal entry. Chapter 9, verses 9 and 10. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king comes unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass or a donkey, and upon a colt, the foal of a donkey. And I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even unto the ends of the earth. Let me just point out again the distinction between the first and second coming. Verse 9 is the first coming. Verse 10 is his second coming. Not obvious from this text, but as we look back from the New Testament, clearly he's talking about two different comings. When he speaks about the king coming as on a riding on a donkey, and even on the colt of a donkey, we know that this is what Jesus was fulfilling when he, you know, went up the triumphal entry and he told his disciples to go ahead and get the donkey and the colt and bring them to him. And he got on, he didn't just get on the donkey, he got on the colt. Now, when you got on the donkey, you were not riding off to what?
War.
You weren't riding off to war. I mean, this was not only a statement of peace. You know, when you were going to war, what did you ride?
Big
a horse. Okay?
Tank.
And you certainly wouldn't ride, a colt. Okay? If you wanted to run off to war, you weren't going to get on the colt of a donkey. This was a statement of that he was coming in peace, but it was also a statement of humility. Here is his humiliation. He comes lowly. Riding on, okay, this is not coming in great glory and great power and to bring judgment. This is coming, bringing salvation as a humble. Remember what Jesus said, come unto me, all ye that labor and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly and humble of heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls. I mean, that's his first coming. He came the first time not to bring judgment, but to bring salvation. So he came riding upon a donkey. Now again, notice, just point out here, notice the literal fulfillment of that. He came to Jerusalem, the literal city, riding a literal colt of a donkey. Okay? So when Christ comes the second time, he's going to come riding a white horse. I rather suspect that that's literal. I mean, he'll be on a white, I don't know how that works, but he'll be riding a white horse, because why wouldn't he? Because he rode a donkey the first time. He came to Jerusalem. He's going to come to Jerusalem. Okay. Now, forgive me. I'm just, you know, that's what the text says, so I take it. But all that to say, notice then verse 10. Now he's talking here about his second coming. He says, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off. What he's talking about here is the end of war. And he says, which is a very common theme in relation to the kingdom in the Old Testament. And he shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion it shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth. So that his kingdom will cover the whole earth, and he will reign in peace. That is what happens at his second coming. Now again, what an amillennialist does with that, I'm just doing this so you understand the differences, because you understand the biggest difference between amillennialists and us. One of the biggest differences is how you deal with the prophets. And an amillennialist would say that verse 10 is referring to the expansion of the church. You know, that so as the church expands through the earth, you know, it's bringing the dominion of Christ to the earth, and you know that this is the peace that is being brought to the earth, the gospel being spread to the world. But that's why I say the preaching of the gospel is not the fulfillment of the kingdom promises of the Old Testament. that's a whole other story. Okay, but at any rate, I understand that to refer to when Christ returns in his second coming. He will have dominion over the whole world. He will... Okay. Chapter 11. Now, this one's a little more obscure, and I'll be honest with you, I'm still a little foggy on this one. I'm just going to read it to you to let you know that this is generally understood to be a reference to the Messiah. I'm just going to read it and make a couple of comments. But verse 4. Now, the reference to the Messiah is towards the end, but this passage, it speaks of the rejected shepherd. I'll start in verse 3. There is a voice of the howling of the shepherds, for their glory is spoiled, a voice of the roaring of young lions, for the pride of Jordan is spoiled. Thus saith the Lord my God, feed the flock of the slaughter, whose possessors slay them and hold themselves not guilty, and they that sell them say, blessed be the Lord, for I am rich, and their own shepherds pity them not. For I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land, saith the Lord, but lo, I will deliver the men every one into his neighbor's hand and into the hand of his king, and they shall smite the land, and out of their hand I will not deliver them. And I will feed the flock of slaughter, even you, O poor of the flock. And I took unto me two staves, the one I called beauty, and the other I called bands, and I fed the flock. Three shepherds also I cut off in 1 month, and my soul loathed them, and their soul also abhorred me. Then said I will not feed you. That dies, let it die, and that is to be cut off, let it be cut off, and the rest eat every one the flesh of another. And I took my staff, even beauty, and cut it asunder, that I might break my covenant which I had made with all the people. And it was broken in that day, and so the poor of the flock that waited upon me knew that it was the word of the Lord. And I said unto them, If you think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for me my price, 30 pieces of silver. This is the rejection of God's shepherd. The point here in generals, this is how I understand it. He's condemning the shepherds of Israel who were evil and were wicked. But God's shepherd, who God sent to shepherd his people, was rejected, and it speaks here of his rejection. And this is, of course, referring to the 30 pieces of silver that Judas received in order to betray Christ. That was the price, right? This is the fulfillment of this passage was when he was betrayed by Judas. Verse 13, and the Lord said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a goodly price that I was prized at of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Then I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. So again, the Messiah there being this shepherd, of God's shepherd, who was rejected by them. Probably the most well-known passage in the book of Zechariah is Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. I'll start in verse 9. It says, and it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. Now again, I take that to mean ultimately the day of the Lord. Again, the book of Revelation, when he calls all the nations to the battle of Armageddon. Joel chapter 3, when all the nations come against God and against against Israel. Verse 10, and I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. So, this is referring to that day when the Jewish people will finally recognize their Messiah. Now again, notice verse 10. I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications. I understand this to mean that God is going to grant them salvation. He's going to grant them grace so that their eyes will be opened. You remember how Paul talks about there's a veil over the Jewish people. They cannot see the Messiah. They cannot see their own Messiah. That veil is taken off here in verse 10. He will give them the spirit of grace and supplications. In other words, grace meaning salvation, the gift of salvation. Supplication means they'll call upon the Lord from out of a true heart. Notice, this is true everywhere in Scripture. I mean, you know, it's a little bit what Paul was talking about at break. When there's salvation, it is a gift. God grants the ability to actually see who Christ is and to call upon the Lord. You know, and this is how it's seen everywhere in the Bible. You know, Paul talks about, you know, being gracious towards those who contradict themselves in unbelief, right? Because he says, lest peradventure God give them repentance. Okay, let us be patient with unbelievers, because listen, God needs to work in their heart. He needs to change their hearts. And so this is the grace of God. But then he goes on further. It says, and I love this, they shall look on me whom they have pierced. Who's speaking here? Yahweh, the Lord. They will look on me, Yahweh, whom they have pierced. Who is the Messiah? The Messiah is the Lord. Okay, so he says, they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him. In other words, they will, again, this is what MacArthur points out with Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 is their testimony in this day, that they will look on him and they say, oh, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was wounded for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. That's when they will look on him. They will realize that they, the Jews, put their Messiah to death. They rejected their Messiah. And they will come to understand that it was through their Messiah, that it is through their Messiah that their sins are washed away. And this is when salvation comes to the Jews as a nation, as a whole people. Verse 13, or chapter 13, verse 1, referring to that time. In that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. In other words, in that day the Jews will be purified. You understand, this is like a focal point in the Old Testament prophets of the kingdom, when the Jewish people finally are holy, when they are pure, when their sins are forgiven, when they recognize their Messiah. This is the, you know, this is Isaiah 12. This is the day of salvation to the Jewish people. Okay?
Isn't that true of all believers, though? Is that when you realize the depth of your own sin and that he paid
for it? Absolutely. Yeah, that is the nature of salvation.
But I understand that this is the salvation.
But don't miss the point that these passages are referring not to individual salvation. I mean, it is. But it's the whole point of the new covenant in the Old Testament in its prophecies is that the whole nation would be purified, that the whole nation would believe. It wasn't just that one or two people or a few, but at the end, the remnant that's left, they would all believe. But you're right. what is said about the Jews in that day is also true of us when we're born again, right? I mean, it's the same thing. We're given the spirit of grace, or grace and supplication, right? We're given the ability to see who Christ is.
In a sense, this is kind of the consummation of God's salvation plan when this he sweeps Absolutely. The whole nation of Israel, the remaining nation of Israel on earth, into the kingdom.
Exactly, right? Which is what Paul speaks about in Romans 11, in that day, right? All of Israel will be saved. That's the future. That's not talking about the church. It's talking about Israel will be saved. Right now is the day of the Gentiles. Right now is the day that God is reaching out to all people of all tongues and nations and tribes. And when he's done and he brings all of the church in, then he will, once again, he will deliver the Jews. I mean, there's a sense in which the testimony of the Jews in that day is chapter 12 of Isaiah. I'll just read it real quick. It's a short chapter. In that day thou shalt say, O Lord, I will praise thee, though thou wast angry with me. Thine anger is turned away, and thou comfortest me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. For the Lord Jehovah is my strength and my song. He also has become my salvation. Therefore with joy shall you draw water out of the wells of salvation. And in that day shall you say, Praise the Lord, call upon his name, declare his doings among the people, make mention that his name is exalted. Sing unto the Lord, for he has done excellent things. This is known in all the earth. Cry out and shout, thou inhabitant of Zion, for great is the Holy One of Israel in the midst of thee. That's going to be their testimony. Now, is that our testimony today? At a certain level, it is. I mean, I can read that and say, yeah, that's true of me, but it's not the literal, complete fulfillment of that passage. That is an application of that passage, but the fulfillment of that passage is in the day in Zechariah 12 when the Jewish nation, as a people, believe in their Messiah, see him, call upon him, and actually Jehovah becomes their salvation. That's the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecy.
Something else that points to the fact that this is dealing directly with the Jews, from verse 11 through 14, I believe what it's talking about there is when they do get saved as a nation, that it, because it talks about
correct, you know, about them mourning,
every family right. by itself, the wives by themselves. I think what it's referring to is men and women, obviously being from different families, and the children themselves, they're going to look at their 2,000-year history of the rejection of Christ yes. and realize they've lost all their family members, and that can't be the church, because the church has been being saved through that right. period of time.
Right. No, it's true. I would agree that is what's happening there. They are mourning over their whole history in a sense. You know, they had adamantly rejected their Messiah.
That's painful.
It will be. Yes. It will be both. In some respects, it will be a time of great sorrow. In another, it will be of great joy. I mean, like salvation, right? I mean, but that's. Let me go on here. There's actually this whole section from 12 to 13, 14 is interesting, but I'm not going to cover everything. Verse 7 of chapter 13 also speaks of the Messiah. Jesus refers to this passage at the Garden of Gethsemane. Or the Last Supper. But he says in verse 7, Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts, Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. Excuse me. So speaks again of the suffering of the Messiah, that he would be smitten. Now, verses 8 and 9, I think are referring to the great purification of the Jewish people at the end of the age. It says, it shall come to pass in all the land, saith the Lord, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. I will bring the third part through fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, It is my people. And they shall say, The Lord is my God. That again is the tribulation, the great tribulation that will result in them actually that remnant calling on the name of the Lord. Again, I think verses 8 through 8 and 9 are the context of when they look on him whom they have pierced. Now, verse chapter 14 is interesting of itself, and I'll just read parts of it here, but this whole chapter is fascinating. It says, "Behold, the day of the Lord comes, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle." Now, when I see that again, I'm thinking, day of the Lord, thinking Joel chapter 3, okay, it's the same event, Armageddon, Revelation. "So I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city." So then it says in verse 3, "Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle." I understand that to be the second coming of Christ. So notice what he says in verse 4. "His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west." Let me stop. Notice, where does this, I believe, is referring to the return of Christ. Where does he come when he delivers Jerusalem? He comes to the Mount of Olives. Where is the Mount of Olives? It's just east of the Kidron Valley, east of the temple, right? East of the temple. What happened there?
It's where he rose.
It's where he ascended, right? It's where he ascended into heaven. Remember, Jesus said, "In the same way that I'm departing, I will return." It would be the same place. It would be the Mount of Olives. Where is Christ going to return? To the Mount of Olives. But notice also when it says, "And his feet shall stand in that day," who's his feet? Who's his? What's the antecedent? Look at verse 3. "Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations." Who is that? That's Christ. Yeah, well, again, it's the Messiah is the Lord. Mm-hmm. This is another example of, you know, when it says his feet, it's the Lord's feet. That is the Son of God, the Messiah. So again, this is another example, I think, where if you just look at it, it's pointing to the fact that the Messiah is the Lord. The Messiah is Yahweh. So he goes on. And notice what happens when he comes. "The Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a great valley, and half the mountain shall remove toward the north and half of it toward the south." Now, I take that in a very straightforward way. I think that's exactly what's going to happen. I think the Mount of Olives is going to split. There's going to be a great earthquake, and the Mount of Olives is going to split, and there's going to be a great valley there that wasn't there before. I just take it in a straightforward, literal way, okay, because I don't know how else to take it. So, verse 5, "Ye shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azal. Yea, ye shall flee like as you fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And the Lord my God shall come, and all thy saints with thee." Think Revelation 19. That's exactly what it's referring to. You know, the Christ returns with the saints. Notice again, who is it that returns? Or who is it that comes? The Lord my God. Again, another statement of the fact that the Messiah would be God himself. And verse 6, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. And it shall be in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea and half of them toward the hinder sea, in summer and in winter shall it be." Again, forgive me, I have to take that literally. I think that there's going to, when it talks about the sea, it's talking about the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea. Verse 9, "And the Lord shall be king over all the earth." Notice again, the Lord himself shall be king over all the earth. "In that day shall there be one Lord and his name one. All the land shall be turned as a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place from Benjamin's gate unto the place of the first gate and the corner gate with the tower of Hananel unto the king's winepress. And men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited." That's a fulfillment of the Davidic covenant. It's the same language. This is what happens when the Messiah comes. Israel will dwell safely. There will be serious geographical changes in Israel. And as you go down through the rest of the passage, and I'm not going to read the rest, you'll find that, and this is one of those passages that speaks, I think, plainly to the fact that during the millennium, during that kingdom, there will be sacrifices, because it speaks of them at the end of the chapter. The context of this is when Christ comes in glory. And, you know, I don't know how to get around that. I mean, this is obviously talking about the second coming. Now, if you turn this all into metaphor, you can make this refer to his first coming. And I think that there are some that do that, that actually turn this, that all this refers to his first coming. But that can't be. This is not his first coming. This is so obviously his second coming. This is so obviously it's the same thing as happening in Revelation 19. This is, again, why I'm a premillennialist. Okay? The kingdom comes after he comes in glory. That's when the kingdom comes. And the kingdom's described in chapter 14, when he's king over all the earth. And it talks about the nations coming to Jerusalem. And it talks about the Jews celebrating this Feast of the Tabernacle. All that happens after Christ comes in glory. You see, well, I don't know why God would do it that way. I don't know why God would do it that way. I only know that that's what he says he's going to do. So I just leave it at that. Okay? This is what he says. Okay? I take it in a very plain, simple way. Now look at verse 20, the end of the book. In that day there shall be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord, and the posts in the Lord's house shall be like the bulls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and seed therein. And in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. That's the millennium. That's the kingdom, okay, when Christ returns. Real quickly, I have to look at two passages in Malachi. Chapter 3, these are very important passages. Also post-exilic prophet, the last prophet in the Old Testament. Not just in the canon, but actually in time. Chapter 3, verse 1. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. Now, who's the messenger there? Referring to
John
the Baptist. Notice he says, shall prepare the way for who?
Me.
Me, meaning the Lord, meaning the Messiah. And the Lord whom you seek, that's the Messiah, shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant. Now I understand the messenger of the covenant is not the same as the messenger in the first part of the verse. The messenger in the first part of the verse is John the Baptist. The messenger of the covenant is the Messiah. Whom you delight in, behold, he shall come, says the Lord of hosts. And then, verse 2, this is actually referring to his second coming. But who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and like a fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto the Lord as in the days of old, as in former years. And he says, and I will come near to you to judgment. I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, against the false swearers, against those that oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow, the fatherless, and the turn aside the stranger from his right. Fear not, saith the Lord of hosts, for I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore, ye sons of Jacob are not consumed. Observe, whenever you see statements about the Messiah judging the heathen, judging Israel, judging the world, you are talking about his second coming. When you talk about them being purified and being holy forever, you're talking about the nation of Israel. You're talking about his second coming. You're not talking about his first coming at that point. And this is referring to the time when he will actually bring judgment. He will bring, and notice it speaks of the fact that he's going to purify the sons of Levi so that they will offer in righteousness. I love that song in the Messiah, in Handel's Messiah. But again, I don't turn that into a metaphor and say that the sons of Levi are referring to us as priests of, because we're called priests in the New Testament, but we're never called sons of Levi.
Right.
Okay, we are not sons of Levi. We're not the fulfillment of this passage. The day is coming when the Jewish people will believe on Christ, they will be purified, and they will offer sacrifices in righteousness, which they never did before. And this is, again, one of those places that points to the idea there will be offerings in the millennium. Mm-hmm. Okay? There will be offerings in the kingdom.
Offerings as in?
Sacrifices. Yes. They're not identical to the sacrifices because actually they're described, like in Ezekiel. They're not identical, but there are similarities and there are parallels. This is not going to be an all-out return to the old covenant. They're going to be, it's going to be a different system, but there will be parallels. And Zechariah 14 talks about the Feast of Tabernacles. But it's not going to be identical to the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, or the old system. But there are going to be sacrifices. Now, if you look at chapter 4, verses 1 through 6, this is how the Old Testament ends. Looking forward to the day of Messiah. And this is, by the way, Jesus, and John the Baptist, I should say, refers to Malachi when he announces the coming of Christ. For behold, the day comes that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. Again, when you read that, you should automatically think the day of the Lord, the day of judgment. And the day that comes shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. That is the Messiah. You shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall, and you shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. That is the day of the Lord. Verse 4, remember you the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. He shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Now we know that there is a sense in which John the Baptist was this Elijah. But there's another Elijah in the book of Revelation, Revelation 11. There's an Elijah and a Moses type figure that come before the day, that come before Christ comes in his glory. So, again, John the Baptist was kind of a pre-fulfillment of the ultimate fulfillment. But at any rate, this was the end of Revelation for 400 years, and the Jews were waiting. So when John the Baptist came and actually called them to repentance and announced the coming of the kingdom, he was referring to this passage. Now, there's a lot to say about that, but I don't have time. I'm out of time. Let me just point out, page 35, bottom here. The Jews were fundamentally looking for this great judge that was going to come in glory and to deliver them from the Roman Empire. But they did not understand that he came first of all to bring salvation and to pay for the sins of his people. And that was what was hidden. Again, this is the brilliance of God. It was hidden to the wise and the prudent, but he revealed it unto babes. And if I had time, I would take you through the book of Matthew and show you how this was opened up. Because when John the Baptist came, he was announcing the day of the Lord, as if the day of the Lord were here. And he actually uses these judgment passages talking about the wrath of God. But then Jesus, as the Jews rejected their Messiah, Jesus opens up this idea that there will be this, he does this especially with the parables in Matthew 13, the parables of the kingdom, where there is this period opened up wherein there is the preaching of the gospel, and then at the end of that period, there is the great judgment. and then the parables of the kingdom, there is this idea that at the end of the age, there would be this judgment coming. And Jesus, masterfully, through the book of Matthew, opens up this idea of a period between his first coming and his second coming. That there's this idea that there's this period that was a mystery in the Old Testament. That's why we call them the mystery parables, the mystery kingdom, the mystery aspect of the kingdom. It wasn't clearly revealed in the Old Testament that there was this first and second coming, in the middle of which was this period of an undesignated period of time wherein the gospel would be preached to all the world. And this is the church. It's the church age. The church is not Israel. The church is this thing between that was not revealed in the Old Testament. It's the age of the Gentiles. It's the time when God is calling a people unto himself. It's really amazing how the Bible works.
This is the thing that Larkin drew the sketches of with the Old Testament prophet looking forward into future, can't see past the mountain peaks.
Correct.
And the church age is in between the mountain peaks.
Correct. Yeah, no, that's the idea. Is that Larkin that did that?
Clarence Larkin.
So if you're... that's not a very good drawing.
Yeah, you just got to space them out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. You know, if you have like a mountain here, and you have a mountain here, okay, I guess you have to draw this one higher so you can see it.
Yeah.
If you're way down here, right, and you look down, you just see two mountains. They look like they're right next to each other, right? But then when you actually get up to this mountain and you get on the top and you look down and there's this huge valley, and then there's the mountain, right? And that's kind of, okay, there's this first coming, second coming. When you're looking at them from way down here as a prophet, you're looking at those mountains, you just see there's prophecies about his humiliation, there's prophecies about his glory, and they seem to be intermixed, and they're in the same paragraph, sometimes in the same sentence. And then when you get to this point, oh, there's this huge valley here between, see, and that was the beauty of the way God designed it. And you couldn't see that from the Old Testament. Now, I argue that when you get to the end of the New Testament, there was another thing that was opened up that was never seen. You could not see it clearly from the Old Testament. And you couldn't see it clearly from the New Testament. When you get to Revelation 20, you find that the kingdom is divided into two parts. There is the millennium, and then there's the eternal state. When you go to the Old Testament and you read these prophecies in Isaiah, they're all together as if it's just one. And they're mixed up in a similar way. But when you get to the book of Revelation, verse chapter 20, you find that there's two separate things. And they're not identical. And that the millennium actually has a reversal of the curse, but is there still death? There is. And Isaiah talks about that, right? It talks about in the kingdom, what it talks about, a man will die at 100, it'll be like he's an infant. Well, that's not heaven, because there's no death in heaven. That's the kingdom. Well, that's the millennium, right? But those prophecies are mixed up together in the Old Testament. And when you get to Revelation 20, it's like God, again, each time we get further out, God like opens up the telescope a little further. You know, and we get to the end, even to the end, right? Okay, yeah, there's a 1,000-year period. We call it the millennium. And then at the end of that is the eternal kingdom, okay? So you understand that God has a way of hiding things, even as he has a way of revealing things. Yes?
One of the things with that is, like, you talk about that the Messiah will rule and reign on the throne of David forever, but he starts that in the millennial kingdom, but the earth is destroyed, and we get a new Jerusalem.
Well, there's a question of, and I'm not sure the answer to this question. When it talks about the destruction of the heaven and the earth, does it mean a complete eradication of the old, or does it simply mean a renewal? And I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. But I do know this, that everything that that God said would happen will happen exactly as he said it. And when we look back, we'll say, oh, okay, yeah, that's that's how that worked. yeah, So what the new heaven and the new earth, when you have the new Jerusalem that comes down, I mean, that's in Revelation 21 and 22. That is the eternal state. But you understand that it is also the fulfillment of the kingdom. I mean, the kingdom idea of Scripture covers all of history. And the people that refer to the millennium as the kingdom, that's really not quite true either. I mean, it is an aspect of the kingdom. But the ultimate fulfillment of all the kingdom promises really is heaven. I mean, that is true. But, you know, if you try it, well, I'll stop there. Any other questions before we close? We will, again, here's the...